This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hello and welcome to the Music to My Ears podcast, brought to you by BBC Music Magazine, the world's best-selling classical music monthly. This week we're speaking to the Australian saxophonist Amy Dixon about the music that shaped her life, from Spanish piano music to Philip Glass. Sydney-born Amy Dixon rose to fame in the UK after she became the first saxophonist to win the gold medal at the Royal Overseas League competition in 2004. Throughout her career, she's remained committed to commissioning new music and writing her own transcriptions of existing works, such as Philip Glass's Violin Concerto, a recording for which she's best known. As well as performing across the world as a soloist, she has also founded the Take a Breath program, designed to help young children learn breathing techniques to help with stress. She met our editorial assistant, Freya Parr, at our studio here in Bristol before the UK lockdown began.
Right, so welcome to Bristol.
Thank you.
This is a podcast all about listening and the music you love and that kind of has defined your life. So how do you tend to listen? Do you listen on the go, or do you kind of tend to plant yourself at home and really chow down on some good stuff?
Yeah, the way I listen to music depends on what is happening in my life. I'm either touring or I'm at home. And when I'm at home, I just stay at home. a bit of a hermit. But I love listening to music when I'm traveling, if I'm on a plane or on a train, and I just hear it differently, especially on trains for some reason. And if I'm at home, I guess it's more kind of work, like just listening to repertoire, listening for repertoire, trying to find new repertoire things that I can transcribe or arrange or, you know, turn into saxophone repertoire.
So are you a streamer or are you a record listener?
Yeah.
How do you tend to listen?
I am now a streamer.
You've transitioned.
It's just turned into this. It's so convenient. You know, if somebody says, go and listen to this, it might sound good on the saxophone, I can actually that second put it on my Spotify.
So on to the first probing question. So what was the first piece of classical music you fell in love with?
I think the first piece that I can remember that I really, really loved is called Andalusia by Ernesto Lecuona. And it's this kind of rollicking, kind of Spanish sounding kind of fun piece on piano. And I used to have it on a tape. It was this obscure tape with a compilation that some pianist had put out. I don't even know. Remember who it was, but I was very, very young, and my mum had it in the car, and I used to listen to it in the car, and then annoyingly for everybody else in the car, I would, as soon as it came to the last note, press rewind, and I'd know how many seconds I had to count it before I had to press stop so we could get exactly to the first note again.
So you drove everyone nuts with that,
completely
that
nuts,
habit.
Yeah.
It's funny, there's something about listening in a car that you, it's like how you mentioned how you listen on the train. There's something about there being absolutely no distractions other than the kind of passing of the landscape outside that really makes you kind of tap into those.
Completely. I know you just hear music differently. My dad's the same, actually. He never listens. He never watches films on planes, and he's always on a plane. So he only listens to music. It's, it's a wonderful way to listen to music, especially with the headphones that you can get these days. It's great.
Yeah. And also, I guess, with back in the day with all those cassettes that we had, everyone had very few things and like things to listen to in the car, so you kind of tended to repeat listen to like a few
exactly.
cassettes again and again and again.
Yeah, I loved cassettes.
How old were you when you kind of first encountered that piece of music?
Oh, 5, 6, 7, that kind of age, I think.
And is that a piece you kind of came back to in later life?
Yeah, so I was also a pianist until I was about 18. Piano was my main instrument. And when I was about 15 or 16, my mum, bless her heart, called everywhere that she could think of to try and find the score for this piece. Couldn't find it anywhere, but there was one really obscure library in Western Sydney. It was about an hour and a half drive from our house, and she drove and hired it from this library so I could play it. And it's very sweet.
That's quite interesting that your first kind of way into classical music wasn't with a convent like a traditional Bach or Mozart or Brahms or someone like that. It was kind of through that kind of Latin American entry. Do you think that kind of, I don't know, if influenced your later interest in that genre and how it intersected with classical music?
I think it probably just symbolizes a wide interest in different genres, because I played completely different things from day to day. Completely different things, and a lot of the time it just depends upon how I'm feeling at the time as to what project I go for and or what's going on in my life. And there's a lot of variety in what I do, probably because of the nature of the instrument that I play.
Yeah, that's very true. Fab. So another look back over your kind of musical life. This is the million-dollar question for most music lovers of any genre. What is the best concert you've ever been to?
Gosh, that is probably the hardest question to answer. And of course, I've been to a lot of amazing concerts. The one that just, I don't know why, but it just jumps out in my mind is I went to the Royal Festival Hall, I think in 2011, to hear Please Sell On Plea. And Boulez was conducting, Barbara Hannigan was singing, and I don't know if it was the last time that he conducted it, but it was certainly one of the last times. And it just felt like this momentous night, and that the atmosphere was extraordinary. And I think everybody in that audience really, really, really wanted to be there because they knew how special it was. I don't know. It's just the spirit of the evening. I think a lot of the time concert halls have a spirit, and I find that often when I turn up to play in a concert, you know, you can just feel the atmosphere, and sometimes that lends itself to the experience of the concert more than a lot of other things.
That is, I mean, like, it's a pretty stellar lineup that you mentioned there with Barbara Hannigan and Boulez. Is that a piece that you've heard again in concert elsewhere, or do you think it was just the kind of the chemistry of that evening?
It was the chemistry. It was, it was the atmosphere, the chemistry. It was just electric. It was amazing.
Thank you. Okay, so this is kind of your desert island question, really. Mm. Which piece do you not think you could ever live without?
The piece I think I couldn't live without, but more from a playing perspective than a listening perspective, although I love to listen to it, is Philip Glass's first violin concerto. And it's the reason for that is I transcribed it about 10 or 11 years ago and for soprano saxophone, and have ended up playing that more than any other piece of repertoire. And it's just become my thing. I play it a lot and I absolutely love listening to it. And it really tugs at the heartstrings for me. And every time I play it, there's still something really new to discover in it.
Yeah, it's a piece that you've recorded twice. Have you recorded it?
I've recorded the concerto once, and yeah. I also recorded his violin sonata.
Yes.
And some arrangements of some of the pieces that he wrote for the film The Hours.
Yes. So what is it about his music in particular that really stands out to you? I guess he kind of does a bit of that crossover of various genres that you spoke of that really interests you.
Yeah. The things that I love, especially about the pieces that I've recorded of Philip Glass's, is they just draw me in a very emotional way. I remember the first time I was played the violin concerto, and it was by a friend invited me around to his house and played me this recording of Gidon Kremer performing it, and I loved it, and I was feeling quite emotional at the time. My parents were getting divorced and it was just a bit of a rough time anyway. And that piece just really hit something in my heart. And this friend said to me, do you think you could play that on the saxophone? And I said, no, don't be stupid. There's nowhere to breathe. And, you know, it's completely out of range. And, it's just way too high. And I'd have to change loads of notes. Anyway, I became so obsessed with it over the months that followed that I tried it out, and I wrote out a straight transcription without altering any notes, because when I transcribe, I really try very hard not to change any notes if possible. And sometimes that means months and months of practice to kind of get my fingers around, especially the really high notes. But anyway, I did it, and then I worked on it for a bit, and then I asked Philip Glass for permission to record it, which he very kindly gave. And yeah, and then so I recorded it with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and I've been performing it ever since. It's become a very close piece to my heart.
So I would imagine there's quite a lot of circular breathing involved in that.
Yes.
To kind of keep those phrases going, because even on the violin it's relentless.
Mm,
what was your process of kind of working with that piece and really...
Yeah, it was interesting. I didn't know how to circular breathe when I decided to ask Philip Glass for permission.
Wow,
I'm
bold.
An ambitious person. Yeah, a bit of an idiot. So he said yes, and we brought to the orchestra. I thought, gosh. So I just taught myself, really. I have a very good friend who's a didgeridoo player, so I kind of watched him. But I just did it a little bit, kind of half an hour every day, and it was the most miraculous kind of process. It was like learning a new life skill as an adult, and to witness that growth process was really, really interesting. And so, you know, after 2 weeks, I could kind of do it, and then after 6 months, I could do it without people being able to tell that I was doing it. And to go from that, from nothing to that, was really interesting.
Yeah, that's incredible. So is that, obviously you've performed that and that's a piece that you really have quite a connection with as a player, it sounds like. Do you feel a similar connection when you hear violinists play it, or do you think it's that experience of playing it yourself that really strikes a chord?
I do feel very connected to the piece when I hear a violinist playing it. However, I think it's a very different piece of music, and usually violinists who hear me performing it say that they think it's a really, really different piece of music. And, you know, that's part of the beauty of the transcription process. One of the most interesting things for me is that the soprano saxophone can have this a similar tone colour to various woodwind instruments within the orchestra, which the violin doesn't have. And so especially in the second movement, there are passages where the solo part is mirrored by various woodwind instruments. And so we kind of merge into each other and produce this homogenous kind of effect, which is completely different to when it's a violin playing the solo line. So, yeah, little things like that I find very interesting.
It just brings out different elements of the orchestra. Yeah, that's great. So obviously that's something that you've had to work on as a kind of a transcription and an arrangement. Do you have to be quite creative with the repertoire that you play for the sax? Because obviously it's still fairly limited in the scheme of things.
Yeah, I'm constantly transcribing. I spend a lot of time, most days, sitting there writing things out by hand, which is great. Sometimes, you know, it doesn't work. Sometimes it does. I also work with composers a lot, and you know, from my experience of working with composers, I think that the composers who, I think most composers are probably up for people trying out things like that. So I would like to think that most of the time they would approve what I'm doing. But I try and arrange pieces that were written by living composers as much as I can, so that I can ask them for their permission before I record it or anything like that.
Do you tend to liaise with them when you're kind of bringing the piece to life, or is it just a kind of that permission that you need and want?
As much as the interaction with composers is basically as much as I can get. Often if a composer is about to write me a concerto, I ask them if I can transcribe one of their previous pieces, maybe a solo piece or maybe something with piano, so that they can hear the way I would play their music and the way their music would sound on the saxophone, especially if they haven't written for saxophone before. If they have, then that's not that important. But I find that often brings out all sorts of, you know, many more ideas in the composition of the concerto later on.
Constantly expanding the repertoire. That's great.
If you're enjoying the music so far, do head to this episode's Spotify playlist, where you can find complete performances of all the pieces discussed, as well as some bonus tracks. You'll find the link in the podcast description.
Fab, so bringing everything kind of back up to date and planting ourselves firmly in 2020, what would you say your current musical obsession is?
At the moment, I'm working on a very, very exciting project, which unfortunately has to remain secret, with somebody from a different musical world to mine. and we're playing different songs to each other just to get to know each other's way of playing. And I find it absolutely fascinating to see how somebody from a different musical world will interpret exactly the same song to how I do. This the thing that I'm fascinated with at the moment is the different emphasis on different notes and the different way that people will sing that through their instruments.
So how do you, are you kind of, when you're playing together with this other nameless individual, what are you performing and what are you showing them that you, from your world?
Well, I think just generally, if somebody were to play a song and, you know, a singer would sing it in one way, maybe a jazz singer would sing it in one way and a classical singer would sing it in another, and I would play it in a completely different way because of the nature of the way somebody plays the violin, they would play it in a different way to the way I play it, and it's, you know, different on, again, on any other instrument. And a lot of that comes down to the physical nature of playing and the way we hold our instruments when we play. That can dictate the way we phrase or the way we interpret music, actually. And so we can constantly learn from people of different instruments and different genres.
Yeah, there's a lot to be taken and from that kind of
completely
cross.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Cross-cultural things yeah. like that. That's brilliant. Yeah. So if you do, you do you listen to music from outside the classical genre as a kind of enjoyer of music as well?
Definitely, and also as you know, as something to work on. I listen to a lot of different genres. A lot of different genres for. To try to see what I might be able to play on the saxophone, and I will play in it in a different way. Play it in a different way, but you know, it will be the same piece, I guess.
Do you, if you're working on a piece in particular, do you enjoy listening to different interpretations of that, or do you try and listen as far away from that particular world of music as you possibly can? Because I think people have quite different views. Artists have different views to what they should be listening to when they're performing.
I mean, it depends what it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, that certain pieces of music require a lot of respect to the composer and reference to the score, and, you know, you can't deviate too much. But then other things like folk music or you know, it's more done by ear and so, yes, listening is hugely important, and I suppose I would study that even more because I'm not that familiar with that genre. But, you know, yeah, it just depends on the genre, I guess.
So are your playlists on your various streaming platforms quite eclectic then?
Yes. In fact, to the extent that every time I make a playlist, I usually take it down instantly if it's been made public, and my record company are constantly berating me for that because it's just I listen to a lot of music, but if anyone ever says, what are you listening to, I kind of, you know, just I can't say it because it will change, you know, if in a few hours time, completely change.
So if I put you on the spot right now and you got out your phone and you checked your musical thing, what would be the last played thing on your phone, do you
Mr.
think?
Mr. Bojangles, because I was dancing around the bedroom with my two-year-old.
That's good. I like it. It can either be ABBA or it can be Wagner. It's like anywhere in between. Fabulous. Well, I think that is perfect. That's a great set of musical recommendations for us to all go away and listen to. So I will send you on your way with Mr. Bojangles.
Thanks.
Thank you, Amy.
I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you.
That was saxophonist Amy Dixon on the music that's defined her life. If you want to hear more from Amy, she's hosting a series of solo sessions during lockdown, which are available on her YouTube channel at youtube.com/AmyDixon. Each week, she performs a piece for solo saxophone and interviews the work's composer via video link from her home in London. We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the team at BBC Music Magazine. Tune in next week when we'll be speaking to another musician about their musical loves. And please do subscribe to this podcast and rate and review it wherever you've been listening. If you want to find more about BBC Music Magazine, we're available in print and various digital formats, or you can visit our website, classical-music.com, where you can read all about the latest musical happenings, read thousands of reviews, and a good deal more. Thank you to Acast for hosting this podcast, and to our producers Ben Newitt and Jack Bateman.